For this and all Clinical Updates podcasts, a 0.25 AMA PRA Category 1 credit will be available for a limited time. To claim credit, view the slide deck associated with this podcast and complete the evaluation found in the slides. Speakers, planners, and CME staff do not have any relevant financial relationships with ineligible companies to disclose.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Clinical Podcast. Today, we are going to be talking about anorexia nervosa. And for that, we have two providers that share their passion in both eating disorders and behavioral health. We have a psychologist, Rachel Peterson. Hello, Rachel. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Of course. And a recurrent conversationist, Zaida Cedarleaf, who's a PA and works in eating disorders. Hello, Zaida.
Hi. Good to be back.
Yes. And you both work together on anorexia. So just to begin with the appropriate definition, Rachel, let's start with you. Can you give me a quick definition of what anorexia nerviosa or nervosa is?
Sure. It's a pattern of disordered eating where people restrict their intake in some fashion. So not eating, over-exercising, and they have a really rigid way of looking at their weight, what they consume, how they consume it, and it results in a lot of abnormal behaviors with food and their body.
This is what I like about psychological conditions. There could be sometimes a fine line between pathology and normal variation. Where does it start being a pathology? Because a lot of people watch what they eat and exercise, so how can you tell apart?
A big thing that we're always looking for when we're thinking about a diagnosis is functional impairment.
Okay. So it affects day-to-day life.
Yeah, okay. And how well we're able to complete our day-to-day tasks and activities. So also things that we want to do, social relationships, fun things also.
Zaida, what's describe the typical patient with anorexia?
Well, that's a tough one because, you know, from a societal standpoint, it would be easy to describe a white cis female who is about 15. She's a dancer. She comes from an affluent family and she restricts her intake. And to some degree, that is a good proportion of our patients. And that doesn't always encapsulate the entirety of anorexia nervosa, which is why we like to highlight that with the DSM-5 diagnosis. They're really strict about the BMI and that it needs to be low in order to have anorexia nervosa. And that, from a clinical standpoint, just isn't realistic to mm-hmm. hold all patients to that standard that a low BMI magically quantifies AN. And so I would say really my better answer is probably that it can come in all shapes and sizes. And kind of like Rachel said, it's that intense fear of weight gain. It's that kind of, I don't recognize the severity of this. People are worried about me, but I don't see that worry. Body dysmorphia. So they're seeing themselves as differently than what the rest of the world is. You're going to see patients with like limited insight and then with that limited risk assessment skills. So I always think about the patient with anorexia who's running. Okay, where are they running? What time of day are they running? Are they wearing reflective gear? Because they're not appropriately assessing their risk because their biggest fear in the world is the weight.
These are people with, in essence, they have a body dysmorphic disorder in part at least.
Mm-hmm. To some degree, yes, that is kind of one of the criteria. Disturbance in bodily experience is how that would be put in the DSM-5. And so it's kind of this like, you know, they see themselves as differently as what they actually might be. And then they'd see their behaviors as differently too. So that's kind of a general big picture. But I think there's some truth to the like classic stereotype, but then also a wide variety of more behavioral type things you'd be looking for. You could see anorexia in any body shape and size. You'd still be looking for it in somebody that's rapidly lost weight that might be living in a larger body.
Okay. Rachel, I want to get into my first, I would call it clinical pearl. These people will tend to have lack of, what's that word, anosognosia or lack of awareness of their condition, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're not going to come and say, hey, I have an issue, I'm not eating. How do they land in the clinic? Somebody force them? Is a catastrophic event? How do they end up in a clinic in general?
I would think partly due to family and friends. So we're seeing a lot of impact on their ability to do things, their willingness to do things like going out to eat or spending time with family and friends, because this food and restrictive behavior is starting to take over their life. And also, their restriction is starting to look like starvation. So they might be having the physical ramifications of literally starving. And as Zeta was saying, that can also be while they're living in a larger body as well. So, you know, having GI symptoms, difficulty sleeping, Zeta can go through a whole slew of physical ramifications as well. So it can be the behavioral aspect that people are starting to worry, behavioral changes, as well as the physical.
Okay. So Zeta, tell me about that, because one of the angles I would like to have here is, as you said, quite often you might not have the textbook patient showing up at the primary provider's office. So for you, they come with a diagnosis, or it becomes straightforward in a way. But give me a couple of the non-typical that, you know, they will bring the family will bring them in, right? If they're minors, underage, and they tell you, hey, he's not eating, throwing up, etc. But what if, how can you tell if somebody's overweight and they bring them, that would be clues to think about this, which sounds counterintuitive to think about anorexia.
You know, the way I describe it to patients when I'm talking to a patient that's living in a larger body that has anorexia, because one of the things with anorexia is that it's a competitive disorder. You don't see that with depression, anxiety, schizophrenia. Nobody competes to be the most sick of depression or anxiety. Yeah. With anorexia, there's a very strong culture, especially in higher levels of care, to be the sickest. And that in that lies, I'm not sick enough because I don't look like this XYZ picture of anorexia. And so what I have to really work hard on with those patients is validating that you can be sick in any body shape and size. And there's evidence to support that, that rates of bradycardia and hypophosphatemia are the same in any body shape and size. I can go into that more, but that's the highlights. But ultimately, how I like to describe it to patients is that genetically, biologically, our body is going to decompensate in different ways, right? So we could take one person, and I like to think of our body's organ systems as kind of like a switchboard that has two tuning dials that go down and up, right? Because what you see for patients that are restricted is all their systems start to slow down. That's why we think of hypothyroidism as a potential reason, because a lot of those symptoms are going to show up in similar ways. And so I've seen patients in larger bodies, for example, that have pretty profound bradycardia. They've lost their periods. They have been having hair fall out. They're cold. Their skin is kind of that pallid yellowish color. Yeah. And they're at a quote unquote normal weight, but their organ systems have shut down. I've seen euthyroid 6 syndrome, right? Where their TSH and T3, T4 are suppressed because of that. But again, their weights are normal. And so they can get by looking and kind of passing, if you will.
Sure.
And then that same genetic person, right? You might just see a different history. You know, I like to joke, you know, we're a bunch of Midwesterners. We've got potato famine farmer genetic history, right? Like we're designed to evolve and survive famine. And so to some degree, their genetics might just support that better than others. And then there's other patients that are going to rapidly lose weight very, very quickly. They're going to have low blood sugars. They're going to have abnormal electrolytes, and they're going to be hospitalized quickly. That's kind of the difference.
I hear that. But speaking of that, is there such a thing as catching it early? Because what you're describing is, I don't want to, you know, take away the expertise, but it's kind of straightforward, right, by then. But is there such a thing of saying, you know, they say they come for a regular visit with the family and you're like, what's going on? And you catch it before it turns into something bigger without getting into, well, you know, he's 15, wants to look better from their perspective and so on.
I think the biggest things that I see get missed when I get a referral, that to me, I look at the chart and I go, oh my gosh, duh, this is a glaring eating disorder. And they've been through the ringer. I've had patients have, you know, CT scans and MRIs to evaluate. Do they have a tumor in their brain, but they're fatigued because they're not eating, right?
Okay.
And it's something as simple as they're fatigued more than normal. Their difficulty concentrating at school. A huge one is they lost their period, right?
Okay.
And that's a big one, right? But those are probably similar. Those are probably the most common three symptoms that I would say we'd want to catch early on. Any weight loss at all is something that we'd be wanting to look closely at, because weight loss and dieting is one of the number one triggers for eating disorders. So I think that would be the big things I'd see on common things that we could be trying to catch early.
Okay, I have one last question before I go back to Rachel. Do they tend to lie, these patients? No, I'm eating okay. Or they will, yeah, I have to eat less because I need to look better or whatever.
I would say if you're talking to somebody with genuine anosognosia, egocentric anorexia, they're going to be so honest with you that they sound like what they're saying sounds so disordered and sick, and they don't recognize it at all.
Like you are the one who's wrong and you don't get them.
They are saying, no, I only eat once a day, every other day, and that's completely normal. Look at me, I'm fine.
Okay.
And it's like, whoa, you don't realize what you're saying. What you're saying out loud is so sick, but you're so casual and nonchalant about it that you don't recognize the severity. That's a really big red flag in my book. That is very, very sick brain. Then there's going to be that middle category of patients that have maybe been to treatment before and they know how to work around these things and they might fudge it a little bit, but we would have to dig in on those symptoms a little bit more and go, okay, but what about this? And actually have them tell you in detail what they ate the day before and those kinds of things to kind of get a better glimpse. And generally speaking, there's some degree of a patient. They're in that visit for a reason. They're there for some help. That means there's some component of them that does want something, whether it's to get all the way better or not. That's not up to us to know in the moment. But there's something there that brought them there that day that we can use to try to help intervene more. So I would say they're still going to be somewhat honest if we are asking the right questions.
Rachel, so this is the part. So you have the patient. It's not straightforward. The family seems to be unaware of what's going on. So two questions. First, how do you break the news to the patient and the family that this is what I'm thinking that may be going on? And number two, what do you think is the role of the families in accepting the diagnosis or perhaps causing this problem, whether intentionally, not ill-intended, but intentionally, or whether it's genetic, etc.? So two aspects of the question.
Well, I think in talking about a diagnosis, oftentimes patients may not like it, but, you know, lining up the symptoms, it sounds familiar, right? They're living this life. So it may be unpleasant, but it doesn't sound wrong.
Okay.
You know? And then talking with the family about what causes it, again, helping or harming. I don't work a lot with families. I don't see kids. So a lot of times, if we're talking about the origins of eating problems, patients that have not had good experiences with eating, role models around food and eating, weight and body image, they can usually point it out pretty readily. Like, oh yeah, my parents, you know, never did this or had problems with X, Y, and Z, and, you know, also helping, they might say.
So it's rarely a de novo thing. There's something that if you start asking may correlate with it.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a totally different ballgame when you're talking about kids, because parents are there hopefully supporting their kids, you know, bringing them in, wanting to see them get better. So if it becomes an issue of, you know, parents being concerned that they did or did not do something to contribute to the illness progression, I think that begins to get more challenging.
So let's get a little bit into management. First question, if we could do a quick yes or no or a couple of details, so one no. Do all the patients in which this is suspected, should they all be referred to the eating disorder clinic?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So great. That's a very useful answer. And the referral is just refer eating disorder clinic, and then you'll take it from there and decide.
Ambulatory consult eating disorders. We're an outpatient program, and we like to say that we treat all spectrums of feeding and eating. So I sometimes see athletes that have lost their periods, but they're maybe not restricting intentionally. That's called relative energy deficit in a sport. So there's no body image issues, but they are in some kind of deficit from a weight and nutrition standpoint. So we specialize in working in those categories too. And I like to think of ourselves kind of as a mid-central Minnesota funnel. We see a lot of central Minnesota, and I do a lot of triage. So we have kids that we're hospitalizing in the cities. We have adults that we're getting down to Melrose and Emily program. So even if they maybe aren't appropriate for outpatients, we can still try to get them where they need to be, whether or not they work with our program or not. And that all kind of spectrums of feeding and eating struggles are things that we can, at least at the very least, shed that lens and provide that perspective for them to make sure that that baseline is being covered.
So you could do a planned hospitalization, or you could counsel on people who end up hospitalized.
I hospitalize from my outpatient setting. Like I said, I direct admit down to CTED. It's called Center for the Treatment of Eating Disorders, St. Paul, Minnesota. They have an eating disorder program for hospitalizing kids. We don't have any hospitalization for adults in Minnesota, but the highest level of care is Melrose Center in St. Louis Park. So we have a pretty good relationship and close relationship with them, where adults, if needed, that are really pretty medically unstable, usually have an evaluation within a week or two. And that's where they can go for higher level.
So it is a thing that can happen that somebody refers an ambulatory consult and you end up telling you need to be admitted and you make the arrangement.
100%. I can usually see in their charts that they meet admission criteria based on just the referral information. And then I will triage them as high priority, get them in, get them to the hospital.
Okay. Now, Rachel, we can manage all the biological disruptions, but you know, there are certain psychological or psychiatric conditions that are, quote, incurable, like pyromania. Is this curable or manageable, or these are people that in their 30s could look back and say, oh, yes, I had this?
I would say curable to manageable. Yeah. I think we see plenty of people that come in and they do well. They do their work, and we're able to discharge them. There are some people that come in that, like Zeta said, need a higher level of care. And there are some people that wrestle with the fact that this is probably going to be with them for the rest of their life to some degree, you know, maybe in periods of higher stress. And that's also the name of the game for lots of other mental health conditions. So feeling like I know my triggers and this is what I'm going to do in those periods of time, and knowing that they can reach out to us, you know, in a couple of years if a lapse happens. So
the statistics of those categories is that somewhere between 10 to 33% of patients die from eating disorders. That's a pretty gnarly statistic. Of psychiatric illnesses, anorexia kills the most people other than opioid overdose. So that's why we don't, I mean, that's a really high mortality rate. So that's a big diagnosis to get, because that it carries that mortality rate with it. But then somewhere about a third of patients have about relapsing and remitting symptoms for the rest of their life, where they might have partial recovery and they might relapse and have to go back to treatment. And then we usually say it's a third. A third have relapsing, remitting, a third die, and a third have full recovery. It's probably a little bit less die and maybe a little bit more have full recovery. But generally, that's kind of the category. So somewhere between a third and 50% of patients have full recovery. They literally, it's something they leave in their childhood, adolescence, in their 20s, 30s. You can recover at any age. And so that's kind of the breakdown statistically as far as the outcomes you'd look at there.
Okay. Statistically, would you say that the longer time someone spends in their acute eating disorder phase, the less likely outcomes. It is. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. That's why with kids, it's so urgent. The faster you act, the faster they get into recovery, the more likely they are to have recovery. If they are relapsing and remitting and that progression prolongs, they're more likely to struggle for their whole life.
Rachel, I have one last quick question. Could you tell me a couple of top two of psychiatric comorbidities that people tend to have, along with these comorbidities, depression, anxiety, and what rate of people do?
Depression and anxiety, for sure.
Okay.
What else? I mean,
PTSD.
PTSD. The trauma component is huge.
OCD, maybe.
OCD, maybe. You can see tendencies along with the food component of eating disorders. Although for a full OCD diagnosis, they have to have other OCD triggers in other areas besides food. I mean, anxiety, depression, and PTSD. So all different varieties of anxiety, like eating, going out of their home. So like the broad spectrum of anxieties, sometimes sleep disorders, substance use disorders, those kinds of things often go hand in hand with eating.
And a quick reminder to everybody, we have also a podcast on bulimia and binge eating, and also one on RDIF, avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. Rachel Seda, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.